Okay, we just want to welcome you to the AABT program relating to the ADA, and backed by more or less popular demand is Sean Barrett, who was a deputy assistant U.S. attorney for most of her life and now has moved into private practice doing essentially the same thing, if I understand it correctly. So she will be answering our questions this evening. But like any good attorney, she wants to be sure we have a qualification that she can't give specific legal advice regarding particular circumstances. We'll just be talking in general and answering questions regarding the ADA. But before we get started, could we just start around the group and everybody quickly give us their name and what level they teach and what they teach?
All right, I'm Susan Glass, and I am president of AABT. I was formerly an English writing professor, and I taught comparative lit classes as well. Retired in 2013 and now do freelance writing.
I'm Tabitha Brecky, and I work at Auburn University as an accommodation specialist, but then I'm also an adjunct professor for the adult education program.
I'm Suzanne Mint, and I'm a Russian history professor, and I also teach world history and Chinese history at Radford University. I've been there about 17 years. That's in Virginia, for anybody who doesn't know.
I'm Jan Hawthorne from Jackson, Mississippi. I taught 4 years as a resource teacher in the public schools, 18 years at the Addie McBride Rehab Center for the Blind, and 17 years at Mississippi School for the Blind in Braille and Technology.
Well,
my name is Nikki. I am from Washington State, and I'm still going to school to get my teaching degree. I'm just about done with my associate's degree.
Okay. And I'm John Buckley, and I taught basically mass communication courses first at UCLA and then at the University of Tennessee. Suzanne, I'm going to start with you because I think you had a question that you wanted to ask Sean, if you recall what it was.
Yeah, that's a good, I don't know. Let's see. I think
I
it was concerning
question.
The tenure case.
Yes.
Is that the whole issue of protected classes? Yeah.
Yeah, you had a couple of them. I'll help you with them if you forget the other one.
I forgot the other one, but this one is a little bit sticky because the situation happened, and this is something I'm not asking advice on, but this did happen, that in my tenure case, student evaluations played a heavy role, and student evaluations were on two separate pieces of paper, one with numbers and one with comments. And some of the comments were absolutely against any protected status class. If they had said this and put in the word black or Hispanic, it would have been thrown out immediately. But because it was blind, nobody seemed to think it was a problem. And so I wonder how protected status works for the disabled in terms of challenging things. And that was particularly sticky because they were you couldn't throw the numbers out because you didn't know who gave what number.
You know, to us, it appears to be the same kind of issue. If they had thrown out answers like, well, you know, we think a man should teach this course, or we don't think a person of color should be teaching this course.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they said. You're nice, but you're blind, so you shouldn't be a professor.
And
that kind of comment, yeah.
So do you know, how did they take that into consideration?
No. That sort of gets into the troublesome part was that the department refused to make any comments whatsoever, so they tipped their hand as to what their problem was. It was that I was blind. And they weren't going to say that was the problem, but they weren't going to say anything else either. So I actually won the tenure case based on lack of procedure being followed. And it was a very sticky, long-term appeal process and very ugly. But I won. But it still has bothered me that it doesn't seem like disability seems to be taken into consideration in the same way other protected class status people are. So
one reason for that is because at the federal court level, disability does not have the same kind of scrutiny as race
mm-hmm.
or gender. But with the ADA, and you know, which certainly applies to educational institutions, I mean, you would think that that would be something that they would just not consider. So I guess the question would be, how much, you know, did that weigh on their decision? Or were they biased themselves?
I think it was both.
Yeah, you probably never know.
No, but I won, so that...
Yeah, congratulations on winning, and I know that it's a horrendous process. Anytime you get into litigating that sort of thing, it's just takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, yeah.
Suzanne, I don't remember if you asked the question or someone else did about the status of AIDS in teaching. And this can be, usually my experience, this usually comes up more for K-12 teaching. School districts often, at least based on the inquiries we get, the standard situation is, I would like to have an aide in the classroom to help with X, but the school district refuses to even consider an aide doing anything.
I think Gary asked that.
Was that it? Okay.
Okay. Of course, what this is an accommodation request.
Right.
And as all of you know, I'm sure it's an interactive process where it comes down to whatever you can negotiate with the school district in terms of what you need. They should take into consideration your primary request, but they don't have to follow it. If they have an accommodation that they feel is as effective, and of course if it isn't, you don't have to take it. But it's really an interactive process. And
but do I understand correctly that they have to offer some kind of accommodation?
If you request an accommodation, they have to offer you something or tell you why they are refusing your request.
Okay.
And most employers have the procedures that you follow to request accommodations. That may be in your individual school district. Probably it would be.
Don't you have to request them in writing?
You can. You don't have to. But it's probably best, especially if you think there might be an issue with it.
Is lack of money a reasonable reason for denial by law?
Yes. The defense is that there are basically two defenses. Is one is that there are no resources available, that it would be a hardship, a financial hardship. The other thing is that it would fundamentally alter the nature of the program. But, you know, when you look at a school district and money, a lot of what they spend and how they spend it is a matter of the budget. Does anybody want to elaborate on the you know,
well,
what might
somewhat location of the district, if a district in a economically deprived neighborhood and they're paying taxes in, say, that county, they're not going to have as much money, discretionary funds, as a district in a wealthier neighborhood?
They may not, but they could probably go to the state Department of Education and, you know, at least request funding if they don't have it already or can't get it.
Well, Sean, this is Susan Glass, and I have a it's hypothetical and real, a situation to talk about here. I need to keep it entirely anonymous. What happens or what is legal or illegal about the following? A K-8 visually impaired teacher has been working in a district for maybe three and a half years, and she's had a para. She has had an aide in the classroom. The district decides to transfer her to another school, but also that they can no longer afford a para, and when she asks for some other accommodations, she's presented with a number of questions that sound like questions you would get on an interview, such as, how will you communicate with your students when you need to write on the blackboard? Or how will you make sure that your students are safe in the event of an emergency? And the district is making noises about letting her go because they can't afford the para, and they're asking her to explain how she will do many, many things. But she's been their employee for three or more years and has been doing these things. I hope I'm being anonymous enough, but I just, what does this sound like or not sound like? Or do I not provide enough information here?
Well, I mean, you're right. It sounds like they're, that does sound like interview questions. And if she's already employed, they should be beyond that point.
Yes.
You know, then you get into, well, what are the essential functions of the job?
Right.
If you can't do recess duty or whatever, maybe you can swap those duties off with somebody else.
Right. Is it legal for her district to be asking her things like this at this juncture? She has been responding to them and trying to give thorough, rational, complete answers in writing. But should the discussion even be taking place at that juncture? I don't know.
Well, you know, the problem with this kind of situation is, what is the motivation? And that's so hard, because do they really want to know how she's going to be able to do those things when she's been teaching for that long, and they could call the other school and say, hey, you know, how did she write on the blackboard, or how, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
That's the really kind of scary part for her too, or this person, is that, you know, what's their motivation?
Yeah.
I'd be afraid to put a lot of that stuff in writing without running it by somebody with a legal background.
Aren't they creating a hostile working environment?
Not really. I don't think so.
You would advise her against putting these things in writing? You would advise her against that kind of response, or?
Well, you know, does she have, if she has a relationship with the principal or whoever, I mean, you know, one of the things that really helps is to just go sit down and talk this stuff out. But that's not always easy to do.
Yeah.
But has she gotten any kind of feedback from the questions that she's answered so far?
The more questions she answers, the more questions she is asked.
Oh, dear.
Susan, are they thinking that the paraprofessional did the writing on the board and was responsible for these things, and they're trying to, are they going at it from that angle, that they had this misperception of what that person was doing?
You know, I don't know, Tabitha. I don't know enough about it. I don't know. I wish I did, because that would help us.
Let me go back.
One option, too, would be to try to get just an informal meeting. I would certainly take somebody with me, even just somebody to take notes or just to be there and listen to what's being said.
I was going to say, with my tenure issues and other things that have happened, I think that's the best piece of advice for anybody to deal with any of this stuff is don't go alone, ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it's yourself, it's so difficult. I mean, I know, I've been in some accommodation situations where I felt like I had to defend what I was asking for. It is so hard and it is so personal. It's much easier to advocate on behalf of another person. So I think, you know, to take somebody with you who can be, you know, fairly level-headed or at least take notes or...
Yes. You know. Kind of like when you go to a doctor for something important, you know, you bring a friend or a loved one, just somebody to help you kind of keep calm and get the notes right and all that, yeah.
Right, just listen, yep. You know.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I think it's more than that because it's a witness.
Ah, I see,
yeah.
Suzanne.
What
thank
is
you.
That?
If it ever gets that far, it's a witness.
It's the same thing that's recommended for IEP, so.
Thank you.
Let me talk about real quickly, Sean, about a couple of questions that were sent in by people who couldn't be here this evening. And this might have been Suzanne's question about whether there's a requirement for materials to be in an accessible format for professional trainings.
So that was mine, yeah.
Okay.
You know, technically, they have to communicate with you. They have to provide effective communication as your employer. In the real world, you're just not going to always get it.
Yep.
Because they do the materials at the last minute. I ran into that some with my job. I would ask for, you know, PDF files ahead of time or whatever, and sometimes I would get them and sometimes I wouldn't. I'd say keep asking. But don't expect to get it a lot or all the time.
I worked for Department of Rehab Services. They used the Rehabilitation Act as grounds for requiring every presenter to provide their files ahead of time so that they could be made available. And they did real well with all the presenters except for themselves.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just hard to... I battled this with the... DOJ has a training center in Columbia, South Carolina. It's actually on the campus of the University of South Carolina. And, you know, I'm going, well, if you would tell them that, and if you are not going to provide this ahead of time, we're not going to use it. They would never do that. Never.
Mm-hmm.
And most materials, I mean, PowerPoints and that kind of stuff that's live, that's another issue. But most handout materials, you can get those in an electronic format, even if it's after the class.
Because that's what's happened with me a lot, that they'll send it to me later.
And I think you just have to keep asking. You know, just keep asking. And one day somebody will say, oh, gee, Sean, I meant to get this for you ahead of time, and I didn't. And so, you know, somebody's thinking, just keep asking. You know, not being belligerent, just keep asking.
I was quite fortunate at my college because my colleagues were very sensitive to that, and when we had college-wide meetings, they would show up with things ready, and people started picking up on it. You know, this, oh, yeah, right, accommodate, you know, and it was an unusually friendly, caring setting in that way. And so if somebody forgot once in a while, well, no big deal. We read it aloud, right? You know. But you're not always that lucky. But they would model things, and then I'd go to a college-wide meeting, and somebody would have remembered the PDF ahead of time.
We had another question that in recent years we've gotten a lot more of these through the website, and it seems to me that they're all the ones I can remember are K-12. It may, sooner or later, it'll be a college issue, but right now it's K-12. And where you get some principals, some school districts who make who believe that if you use anyone else to grade the assignment or assist in reading it in any way, then it's a violation of the student's confidentiality. And so they're making that a real barrier to anyone doing their job. So the question is, which takes precedence? This is kind of a law school question. Which takes precedence, the confidentiality issue or having some kind of a reasonable accommodation to do your job?
Part of it, I think, depends on the nature of the test. If it's an objective test and you have a key, then I don't see why you can't get help grading that in terms of, you know, did they check A, B, or C or whatever.
The problem...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I think it's just something you have to work out with the school district. If it's someone that they hire, I can't imagine that really being that much of a problem.
You mean if they hire the reader?
Right.
Okay.
And, you know, it might be that they may want the papers graded on the premises or at a certain, you know, they may have some parameters about that. That if you sit with your reader in this room for an hour or two or whatever, however you're going to do it, and so that they know how it's being done.
Part of the problem with this is it has to do with the Common Core State Standards in K-12, because now they really frown on giving a straight objective multiple choice test. And of course, they do it for like statewide testing and stuff, but just in your general day-to-day testing, they may want to see all the steps or that a person used to solve their work, or they may require a lengthy written answer as part of an answer rather than a multiple choice. The trend is away from straight multiple choice testing.
Well, I think I don't see if there's any issue there, because if you're having somebody read to you, the problem they think is somebody else sees what happens with these students.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The concern I've always heard expressed is that whoever the reader is, they're going to know what Joe Smith got on his test score, and therefore his test score is no longer confidential.
And I agree with if they were hired by the school district to be a reader, then they're under that confidentiality rule as much as the teacher is.
Well, the teacher doesn't have to tell the person that's reading the grade.
Or, you know, you could maybe number them, or if it's that important, try to do something to so that the identity of the person is not known to the reader. But I can't imagine with someone that the school district would hire that it being a problem. But I remember.
I'll tell you where I've had problems with that is in handing back work to students. That that if I used a student to hand back papers, that other students might see the grades, and that is a concern at Radford. They don't want other students to see other students' work. I had an assistant that came up with a great plan. It's a notebook, and we put sleeves, so the tests would go back in the sleeve, and the name portion of the objective, or the grade portion, wouldn't show, but the name portion would. So a student would come up and find their name and pull their test out, no one else would see their grade.
That's a great idea.
It's an ingenious solution.
Let me go back and try to ask a question I think you touched on earlier when you're talking about, I think, a small rural school district. I guess they don't have to be rural, but where they just don't have much money for much of anything. And when I was talking to some friends whose kids go to districts like this nearby and explaining this phone call we're going to have, they said, what happens, because we see it the other way around, there's no TBI, there's no O&M instruction, there's nothing in the county. What are the legal obligations that the district has to provide some very basic form of services?
Or so much of that's individualized with your IEP and stuff.
Right.
And if you need accommodations, you have to have a 504 plan. But I don't know. They may argue that O&M is not really a part of the curriculum.
That's part of it, yes. Or they argue that even with the IEP that we simply can't afford it, so we're not going to put it in the IEP.
That's what they do, is they don't put what they can't do.
Yep. I mean, that's a problem. Isn't VR now servicing clients that are a little bit younger than they used to?
They're technically supposed to start transition at age 14, but most agencies wait until the student is in their junior in year so that they don't have to have them on their caseloads any longer than the time it takes them to complete their senior year and either go to college or get training for another type job. So they don't have them on their cases forever.
I know in Alabama they start them at 14 VR. They've, at least in the Division for the Blind, they do to try to get them more ready.
Well, that's certainly an option for O&M.
Department of Education here has a cooperative agreement. Used to have a cooperative agreement with Rehab Services, and they could, when their client load was low, go and help a student. But I don't know what the status of that is now.
What about if a student needs to go to, you know, like the State School for the Blind? Then who picks up the tab for that? Is that the district?
No, the district loses their funding, and then I'll let Sean go ahead and answer, but I know that there's funding that goes with the student, and the districts don't like it.
That I don't know anything about.
Okay.
Is this the sort of thing where you can contract with a private provider, some kind of provider, to come in and provide the TVI or the O&M or whatever the services happen to be?
Sure. I think
a lot of districts do it when they don't have a teacher.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I just do catch oil a lot. Or did.
Okay. Be quiet.
All right.
Well, I mean, this is a very vague question, Sean, and I apologize because I don't know how else to make it more specific. And I think you may have touched on this earlier, but I want to be sure we're clear on it. Is it, again, from the inquiries we get through the website, it's I guess not entirely surprising, the number that come from people that are in areas, again, it may be a small town, but I hate to generalize like that, but where no one, including the visually impaired person who's contacting us, their principal, their school district, and nobody knows anything about any relevant federal legislation. Or what they do know is very vague, ambiguous. And so kind of the sense I get is you have a number of people who are more, some of them are more, are better intended than others, and they don't have a clue how to resolve the situation that is presented by someone who's losing their vision or applying for a job and so forth. Do you have any general strategies that seemed in your experience to work best in resolving those kind of situations?
Well, I have a couple of suggested resources.
Great.
One is each state has funding for independent living centers.
Yes.
And those are across disability, but usually there are people who work in those centers that know about accommodations and, you know, to some extent. Then I guess most states do. I know Mississippi does, has a parent training grant. And that's a statewide federal grant for providing training for parents. And I'm sure they do some training as well for school districts. And that's a great resource. You know, if you just start asking around, there are people. We have some people here who, like, are retired Department of Education, Mississippi Department of Education employees, who advocate for students, and they're all the time going to IEP meetings with parents and that sort of thing. And there are some resources out there.
Let me pursue that real quickly. I know you can bring an advocate to the IEP and so forth. If you wanted to, okay, I'm in this situation. I got a problem with my child, and I know nothing about this. Where would I go to find someone who would be a suitable advocate to accompany me?
I would try the Independent Living Center. Oh, the other resource, all states have a protection and advocacy agency. That's federally funded as well. They call it, most states have different names for it. Are you familiar with those agencies? It's a grant from, I don't know if it's not Department of Education, because they do a lot of other things. They do advocacy in education. They also advocate on behalf of institutionalized persons with disabilities, and it's a grant program that every state has. I can try to get you more information, you know, general information about that. But
if you could, that would be helpful.
That's where I would start.
Okay.
The Independent Living Center and your state P&A agency, and then see if the state has a parent training, I think it's called Parent Training Institute. It's funding just to help parents advocate with the school district.
John, are you saying that there are school districts where there's absolutely no special ed whatsoever?
Yes. At least as regards anything vision-related. I can't speak to anything else, but yes.
You know, your own State Department of Education special ed office may be a resource.
That's what I would. That's where I would have started, or Voc Rehab. Even if they couldn't do something for a young child, they might have a referral.
Okay.
That's what I would say, but my just brainstorming.
You know, but you want to be careful, because sometimes the state departments of education don't know as much about advocating for kids as they do advocating for school districts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to be careful. Depends on their perspective.
Okay.
If you want to, John, if this is a real situation, why don't you just email me, and I can try to get the parent training people here to give me the contact, the contact information and wherever this person lives.
I'll take a second on this. It's a real situation, but the parents are extremely clever in the sense that they have basically had an informal conversation with the school district a few years ago, basically saying, if we really make an issue of this, it's going to cost you guys a lot of money. And on the other hand, if we just come to you from time to time and say, here's something specific we'd like for our child, and if we agree between all of us that you will fund those things, then we promise that we will not make a big issue out of this. And so they've got the best of both worlds. They kind of go in with a shopping list and say, we'd like this and this, and the school district says, thank you very much, just don't take us to court, and we're good.
Yeah, that's hard when it's your child. I mean, you're gonna do what's best for your child, and in terms of a policy or in terms of what happens to the next kid, well,
we're getting interestingly enough, and I don't know how much you can generalize. We've had several, I don't know what the number is, parents who are in the same boat, and they can afford to homeschool. And so they just basically opted out of the public school system.
Right.
And well, I think they're getting a better experience.
That's certainly a viable option.
Yeah, but it's one that fits everybody.
Right.
Yeah, but it doesn't ever change the problem. It doesn't
fix
anything.
No,
it does not.
That
doesn't improve
that was
things
be my comment.
In the long term.
And this is a side issue.
I think it does hurt the child.
Pardon me?
I think it hurts the child. They're not exposed to other children and
And I always, I've known an awful lot of good public school educators, and my feeling is that every time, this is a personal only, but every time we pull a child out of the public school, we take away the resources of those parents too. It's a huge investment that we take out of the system, and then we wonder why it's crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's your child's education, you're going to do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
I know. I understand the conundrum.
That's the kind of catch-22 of the whole thing. You're right. It doesn't change the system any. And doesn't
well,
help
it weakens
the next person.
It, actually.
Right, and it doesn't help the next person coming along.
But I had a few other questions specifically related to litigation and quasi-litigation, but that's such an unusual circumstance from what we talked about. I don't want to go down that road here. Everyone else has had a chance to ask the questions that they have. And I can zip through these, I think, pretty quickly, Sean.
Okay.
John, did you get the one I left on your voicemail?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you on the voicemail.
Oh, okay. I left it on, I think, your cell phone voicemail.
Oh, I don't pay attention. Cell phone. I'm still in the 20th century, and damned if I'm going to leave it.
Oh, okay.
I'm with
well,
you.
my question was, and this could apply for students or employees. In my case, it's students I have. If they've been given accommodations, and they've been abusing the accommodations, is there any legal recourse? That can be put into place.
Is this like at the college level or at the...
Yes. Yeah, I have students, basically one of the big ones is the attendance accommodation. And we have students that, I get professors that call me and basically feel like they have to sort of give the student a pass on everything. And I don't think we're allowed to revoke an accommodation once we give it.
Well, when you did give it, was it well documented and supported?
Yes, we require that it's a medical or a mental health issue that a professional has written that it's necessary that the student be absent. And it's supposed to be only for occasional absences that are disability related. It's not supposed to be, you know, to change the format of the class or, you know,
right,
what have you. But it sometimes seems like the student just some of these times, they, you know, if they feel like sleeping in or something, that I don't know, it's sort of how it seems at times.
That's really hard. Because, you know, once you grant it, and yes, it's a legit accommodation. I know that it's written into the 504 policy up at the University of Mississippi, that that's an accommodation that they give. And it's really hard if you've, you know, you've got people who want to take advantage of it. So, you know, then what the college will want to do is to take it away from everybody. And, you know, that's not good either.
Well, that was one of my director's thoughts, is that, well, maybe we could just do away with that thing entirely, you know, for future students. But then what do you do with their medical documentation then, you know?
Can I let you know what I do with students that come to me with that one?
Sure.
When they come in and they bring their accommodations and we sit down and we talk about what they want or what they need, and I have a fairly specific attendance policy in my 100 level classes, and it's basically they choose their number of absences. So what I say to them is, you know, if you get 3 absences, you have an A. If you have 5, you have a B. If you have 7, you have a C. It's like that's, you get a grade in attendance. So what I tell them is, if you really feel like you need this, that you're going to miss a lot of class based on your medical documentation, I will just simply not give you the attendance grade. I'll figure your final grade without that grade in it. And those who have real serious medical conditions are excited about that. Those who are not go, And I say, well, you have the accommodation. You let me know. Do you want me to use that grade or not? Because it ends up helping most students if they come to class.
Yeah, that's a good thought. So in essence, though, there's nothing really you can do to curtail
that. I think once it's medically said that they have that, you can't take it away from them.
I don't think you can take it away from them, but it's, I mean, this is an interactive process also, that the Student Support Services Office, you know, should be involved in helping to negotiate this between the student and the professor.
Because right, and that's the position I'm in,
trying
to help negotiate that.
Because some classes really do require that you be there more often than others, mm-hmm. depending on how the format of the class.
Yep.
Anybody else? Okay. If you think of something, come back and jump in. But, Sean, I'm going to zip through. As I said, kind of litigation and quasi-litigation questions, because these are things that, at least for the people we get, just virtually never come up. But I just kind of want to have the information on record since we have this opportunity for you to visit about it. If someone actually wanted to get some advice or find someone who had a specialty in disability law, or I shouldn't have said it that way, but has an issue related to the AD, what would you suggest that they look for in finding an attorney that would fit that bill?
Well, of course, someone who has that experience.
And how would they know that?
Sometimes the state bar has a referral service where they have lists of attorneys who sign up, you know, to be referred for certain areas of the law.
Okay.
Like if you're looking for a real estate lawyer or whatever, you know, that's one place to look. the advocacy groups, the disability groups, those are going to be the people who know the most about who in the area has taken disability cases.
Okay.
There's an association of advocates. I'll have to get that for you because I don't have it here. I'm just looking at their website. The people who are members are lawyers and non-lawyer advocates. Because, I mean, you've got people out there who I think of as, let's say, an accommodations expert. Sometimes that's what you need at an IEP meeting more than a lawyer. You know, somebody who can make some reasonable and effective suggestions to parents and to school districts about accommodation issues. Let me see if I can get the name of the organization for you, and I'll email it to you.
Okay. Are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay, I didn't know if you were doing it at the moment.
No, I'll email it to you later.
That's fine. When I introduced you, I mentioned that you had worked for the DOJ Department of Justice and now are in private practice. In terms of practicing disability law, how have you found that to differ, and how would it be different for clients?
Oh, how much time do you have? under the ADA, the Department of Justice can bring a lawsuit on behalf of always the government, but also on behalf of an individual. So we got a chance to represent a person. We really always represent the government, okay, but on behalf of an individual. So, and we could do that, and, you know, when the Department of Justice contacts a business or a state and local government entity and says you're violating the ADA, they sit up and listen, and usually they fix it. In the private sector, you know, they want to file all kinds of things and call your client a serial filer and file all kind of nasty motions against you and your law firm, and it's a different world. So not only when you represent plaintiffs, you're going to ask them, of course, to fix what's wrong with it, and most of what we deal with are architectural barrier issues, although we are getting into some website and mobile app issues too. The question of how are you going to fix it and when. And then, under the ADA, all you're entitled to, if you're a plaintiff, is injunctive relief, which means the court tells them not to do it anymore or to fix it, and attorney's fees. And so, of course, in the private sector, you always have to think about the attorney's fees and try to collect those. So there's a pretty big difference.
I know that this is a huge ballpark answer, a lot of variables involved. But when I hear people talk about filing a lawsuit, rarely do they have any clue what's involved. Just talking about lawsuits in general, what are the costs, both financial, emotional, et cetera, if someone's seriously thinking of pursuing that angle?
Most of the time, if you file a lawsuit like this, your lawyer will take it on a contingent fee basis, which means, of course, if you win, they will get anywhere from a third to a half of what you recover. But that really does not include the expenses. And some attorneys are going to charge you, you know, that you're going to have to come up with the expense money, because it costs $400 in federal court to file a lawsuit. And then you've got what it costs to serve process. You got to get your complaint served personally or by certified mail, depending on your state. Then you've got discovery, which is, you know, the depositions. Those cost money. Hiring a court reporter. Those are done under oath in the presence of a court reporter. And, you know, travel costs. Sometimes those expenses are included in the fees and sometimes they're not. It depends on the way the law firm handles that. Emotionally, it just takes on a life of its own. It's a huge deal. In depositions, although some of the questions would be objectionable in court, they pretty much have a free rein to ask you anything that they want to ask you. And your lawyer can object, and you usually have to answer it anyway. Besides that, the lawsuit does nothing for repairing relationships. Generally, it does not. As I look at it, it's kind of a low form of dispute resolution, but basically all we have. I know, John, you've done a lot of mediation, out-of-court mediation, but...
You know, yeah. I think also in my situation back when I was earlier at Radford, there was a lot of sort of unspoken fear that I would sue them, which was the last thing I wanted to do. And I think some of their behavior reflected that. Unwillingness to discuss things, unwillingness to negotiate, which is kind of counterproductive. You'd think that they'd want to do that so they could avoid somebody wanting to sue them.
I think Suzanne makes a good point, and Sean, I don't know if you've ever dealt with colleges, but the thing colleges fear more than anything else at the top of the list is anything that affects their public image. And then number two is anything that affects donors, but those two things are closely tied together.
Sure.
So I can easily picturing, you know, what Suzanne's describing is that just the possibility would terrify administrators.
And, you know, as we talked about earlier, I said be careful about what you put in writing. The risk of that is you don't know how it might be used down the road.
Yeah.
And I've always thought if you did go the litigation route, at the end of the day, even if you win, you're going to have to live with the people that you've been suing, and you just engage in a scorched earth policy. And I've always said if I had to sue a school district to keep my job, I won't say I'd never do it, but it would take an awful lot for me to want to put myself in that situation a couple years down the road.
Well, it happens.
Yeah, you know, sometimes
it's just the only recourse
right.
A person has, but...
I'd have to be worried about not having food on the table or a roof over my head or something pretty extreme to get me to do it. And let me go pick up on one other thing we touched on, and it's a whole other topic, and you may want to just preserve it for another time. The ADA as it's applying to technology and specifically in education, and we hear this both from K-12 and college, and Suzanne, you're more involved in this, I think you might be able to speak to this a bit, is the need to post grades electronically and to interact with some kind of technological system that the university or the school district is using across the board, and you're the oddball who either doesn't want to do it or can't do it.
Yeah, Alan Patel is having issues with that kind of thing. I have some, but I also have an assistant that can do some of the things that the technology doesn't let me do.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put that. I think there are things about everybody's job that the technology won't let you do.
Yeah.
The reality of life.
Even though Auburn has, you know, a policy of trying to make everything, you know, purchase accessible software and things like that, they've got systems like our administrative system, Banner, that are in place that parts of it I can access and parts of it I can't. And so someone else in my office does those parts of, you know, my data entry as an accommodation, which is unfortunate because it delays students getting some of the things that they need slightly. But
at School for the Blind, we had several people who, both of them did not have homeroom. They were blinded. The school system used PowerSchool, and PowerSchool is not accessible for as far as grade entry is concerned. And so those teachers would either email their grade to the homeroom teacher or to the school counselor for them to enter.
So, you know, on some job applications, they'll put things like must have a valid driver's license. And how would they have to prove that that's an essential function, or, you know, how much of the job does that have to encompass for it to be, quote, essential?
I think it just depends on what the job is.
It was something in education that I was looking at.
That was the requirement to be a big brother or big sister in Indiana at one point when I looked into that. And that was a volunteer, no pay, whatever, and they said you had to have the driver's license and they wouldn't back down.
So you can't big brother or sister.
Hence I wouldn't be a big sister, yeah.
Unless you could drive the kid around, is that what they're saying?
I guess so.
Yeah.
See, that's not right.
Exactly.
It's always interesting what assumptions people make. I was also inquiring about becoming a big sister, and I spoke to a woman who said, well, we have some kids who are rather sedentary. We can place you with them.
Ah.
And I thought, huh? Me? I don't think so. And I don't even remember what I said to her, but it was something about, well, I actually move about quite a bit. I may not drive, but I'm active, and I've, you know, told her about yoga and stuff. But it's just funny what you come up with.
That is fun.
Okay, well, we're almost exactly at a little past an hour. But anybody have any additional questions? I don't want to foreclose this. This has been, at least for me, very informative.
Yes, thank you.
It's been excellent.